tonight at 8 o'clock. This is the WQVL repeater.
And I think it's 8 o'clock. Let's see. Don't think I got anything else turned on around here. This is K2RIW. And this time we begin the tech 10 on Limark. For those who haven't heard it before, main purpose for existence is to answer people's questions about this crazy hobby of ham radio, which is a little bit complicated if you haven't already discovered that. People typically ask questions about antennas and transmission lines and favorite transmitters and receivers and modes of propagation and ranges and all this kind of jazz. The TechNet also concerns other subjects of interest to electronic enthusiasts that happen to be ham radio operators. Occasionally we get into FCC law, and maybe we'll do that tonight with reference to CW. We get into high-definition television and satellites and so on. So most subjects of interest to electronic enthusiasts are appropriate to ham radio because it all relates one way or another to computers, wireless, and things like that. So the way a person signs in is to give me your call letters, your name, and you should follow that with a yes or a no. The yes means you do have a question or a comment for the net. So give me your call letters and names at this time. K2RIW listening.
Good evening, K2KY.
Now, this
US2N, Paul. And yes, with the space report. Good evening, Dick.
KT2MDP, Steve, and yes.
Okay, we've got Mel, Paul, and Steve in that order. Who else would like to check in? Give me your call letters and name. Is there some major sporting event going on tonight? Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name, please.
Kilo Charlie 2, Papa Lima Victor, just supporting the net, Dick.
And your name, sir, is?
My name is Steve.
Okay, Steve number 2 with an O and Steve number 1 with a 1. Anyone else to check in? Okay, hey Steve, looks to me like you're going to get an excellent service tonight. Steve number 1, MVP. You're number 1 on the runway. There's not a great big long list. We can discuss almost every single piece of equipment you own there, Steve. KC2MDP, K2IW. Go ahead.
Very good, Dick. I'd like to say good evening to you. Good evening to everyone else out there on the net. My question tonight concerns a grid dip meter. I have the MFJ-259. I also have the 269, which does UHF. And I want to convert an amp. I never did this project because this is one thing that was holding me up. I want to convert an amp to 6 meters, and I got the instructions on how to do it. It basically tells me, you know, I've got to wind another coil in there, I would imagine, take out a 10-meter band and, you know, place this coil 6-meter band. I was wondering basically what a grid meter is and, you know, what it does and basically what am I looking for. You know, I haven't picked the thing up, but I just want to, you know, some sort of insight into this thing.
There's a very interesting phenomenon in physics that it uses. You've seen it in another form. There is a kind of a toy they make where you've got these two posts that stick up above a stand, and you've got a string between the two posts, and you have one, two, or three other strings and weights hanging down from the main horizontal string. You've got some vertical strings. Each of these vertical strings and weights represents a pendulum, and so if you've got the three pendulums tuned very close to the same frequency, so to speak, and you move one of the pendulums, like the middle one, you'll watch the others respond in a very peculiar manner, where they build up an oscillation of their own that gets bigger and smaller. The net result of all this is that, for a bunch of complicated reasons, Mother Nature has set it up in such a way that whenever you've got two resonating objects, whether mechanical resonators, electronic resonators, or whatever, if you put them in close proximity to each other, energy will be coupled from one to another. That very simple principle has a lot to do why a laser operates at a certain wavelength, gives you a certain frequency of light coming out, the laser process itself, parametric amplifiers, the multiple stages of your filter, collinear antennas. There's a whole lot of things that follow this phenomenon. In other words, when two coupling almost doesn't matter, or mechanical coupling. Even crystals, crystal resonators, crystal filters use this phenomenon. Energy will be coupled from one to the other. So the philosophy of a grid dip oscillator is that you have a variable frequency oscillator. In other words, it's an LC network with an amplifier, and you got a variable capacitor, usually. And the variable capacitor is tuned to a dial. And the dial is telling you, as you go to low capacitance, you're at the high end of the band, and as you go to high capacitance, you're at the low end of the band. So the dial is usually calibrated megacycles. So the grid dip oscillator is basically a free-running oscillator where you can tune the frequency by operating the main dial. The oscillator itself runs at some particular amplitude, depending on what bias you put to that oscillating transistor. And it might run at, let's say, the 1 or the 10 milliwatt level. And the oscillator has got a rectifier network connected to it. So the strength of the oscillation gets rectified, becomes a DC voltage or a current. That goes to the meter that's on the front panel. And the meter, therefore, is a kind of RSSI, Receiver Signal Strength Indicator, or an S meter, you could call it. So the dial of the meter movement is telling you signal strength of the oscillator. When you bring the grid dip oscillator near another oscillating circuit, the other oscillating circuit will couple some of the energy out of your voltage controlled oscillator, out of your variable frequency oscillator. Because it's coupling energy out of your oscillator, the amplitude of your oscillator will decrease. Therefore, you'll see the meter go downward. Your signal strength indicator, your S meter on your grid dip oscillator will go downward. As you wrap the main frequency dial back and forth and you make the coupling very light, you can easily find out what is the resonant frequency of that other circuit. The other circuit might be connected to a filter, a final tank circuit, a receiver front end, whatever. Without even turning on the piece of electronics, you can measure what is the resonant frequency of each one of the LC networks that are in your circuit without even turning it on. There's a slight catch to that, because in the case of two black circuits, whether or not the B plus is applied and the filament voltage is applied makes very little difference. The oscillating frequency stays the same because the grid capacitance and the plate capacitance, the tube stays the same. With solid state circuits, life gets a little bit more complicated. If I was measuring the tank circuit on the output of my transmitter, which was a solid state transmitter, whether or not the B plus is turned on determines what is the collector to base capacitance of the transistor. And therefore the circuit's resonant frequency will move a little bit. So you get a little bit of frequency error when you measure a solid state circuit when it's not turned on. Tube circuits, you tend not to get that phenomenon. So the grid dip oscillator will tell you what frequency it resonates on. If you scan for the whole range, you can find out, does your circuit resonate on more than one frequency? A well-made grid dip oscillator oscillates primarily only on the fundamental. It's got very little second harmonic and third harmonic. And most circuits, a simple coil and capacitor put in parallel with each other, which by the way is called an anti-resonant circuit, I think they got it backwards, but that's the name. In series, they're called a resonant circuit, and in parallel, an L and a C is called an anti-resonant. Anyhow, anti-resonant circuit, or a series resonant circuit, either one, you put your grid dip meter near it, and you'll measure the resonant frequency. Most simple LC circuits only resonate on one single frequency, and that grid dip oscillator will find it for you. When it comes to the so-called 432 megacycle strip line parallel kilowatt amplifier, which uses a pair of 4CX250B tubes, and it was published in the April and May issue way back in the dark ages of 1972 of QST magazine, and there was another article with strip line circuits, February 1970 issue of Ham Radio. I wrote both of those articles. Both of those transmitters, the grid circuit and the plate circuit, was tuned with a grid dip oscillator. That's how I found whether or not the resonant frequency was anywhere near where I wanted it to be before I even turned on the tube itself, before I applied any voltages to that amplifier. Therefore, I didn't stand a chance of running the amplifier for a long period of time out of resonance and damaging the tube by overheating it. I made sure everything resonated first with a grid tip meter. I had a UHF version, I think it was a Millen brand name grid tip meter that I borrowed from the salt mine at that time. And it did a pretty good job. So maybe that gives you a little bit of a rundown of what a grid tip meter is. Guarantee if you did a web search on Google for grid tip oscillator, grid tip meter, tunnel zipper is another name for it, a tunnel diode oscillator version Heathkit came out with, which they called the tunnel zipper. It wasn't quite as popular as the Heathkit one that was made, let me think now, mid-60s is when it was a popular item in the Heathkit catalog. I own one, lots of people own the Heathkit grid tip meter. By plugging in different coils, I think the thing goes down to about 1 megacycle, and when you go all the way up to the hairpin oscillator, I think it goes to around 200 megacycles. So by plugging in the right coils, that grid tip meter does cover a whole lot of range. There's a little bit of an art and science to properly using one. You usually start off with the grid tip oscillator placed, the coil on top of it, placed very close to the circuit you want to know something about, and you'll get a great big dip. But you'll also notice the dip occurs over a large percentage of the frequencies that your dial will go to. Then a smart person will back away so that the amount of grid dipping is, the amount of deflection of the meter is less and less, and you'll get the most accurate reading as to what is the exact resonant frequency of your network. And by the way, that network can be a crystal. You can put a coil of wire around the coil of a grid dip oscillator, solder the two wires to a socket, plug in the crystal, and you can measure the resonant frequency of that crystal with a grid dip oscillator. You're measuring the fundamental resonant frequency, and on some rare occasions you may be actually able to see the harmonic frequencies that the crystal will oscillate at. So, as I'm starting to say though, you will back away the grid tip oscillator as far as you can where you can just barely see a dip, and that way you're not creating a significant amount of external loading to your network that you're trying to measure. Therefore, whatever you measure can be done with extreme accuracy as to what is its main frequency of resonance. KC2MDP, KC2MDP.
Good, Dick. Yes, you've explained it quite well once again. So basically, in other words, I'll build this thing. I figure out what it tells me to do. You know, like 10 windings of number 10 aluminum or whatever it is. Do a rock. You know, do my 10 windings. Stick it in there. Check it with the grid dip oscillator. Do like you say. Put it closed. Back it off. Get it tuned in. You know, if it's got any adjustments, you know, then I'll have to either lengthen or shorten the coil. And you know, by trial and error, get this thing in tune. Is that correct, Dick? Back to you.
You got it. Now, if you're building a Heathkit, usually the coils that come with it, just as an example, and the coils are already wound at the factory, so to speak, and done with precision. If you are following someone's instructions as to how to build a grid tip oscillator, minor variations in the way you build the coil, whether or not you use the exact same thickness of plexiglass that you wind the wire on for the low frequency coils, and so on. Minor variations will make your calibration a little bit different. And there's lots of ways in which you can calibrate this. You can literally take the grid dip oscillator, tune it to its frequency range, listen to the oscillation itself on any radio receiver in the neighborhood, particularly with a beat frequency oscillator turned on, single sideband mode, so to speak. And if, for instance, you tune your single sideband receiver to 14.00 megs and plug in the appropriate coil to the grid tip oscillator and rock the frequency dial back and forth until you hear a zero beat tone in that receiver. When you do, you know that your grid tip oscillator is exactly on 14.00 megs and you can put a mark on its frequency dial at that particular point. So by way of using known calibrated receivers, a spectrum analyzer, somebody else's wave meter, even another grid dip oscillator of good calibration, by various techniques, you can calibrate the exact frequency of your particular grid dip oscillator, grid dip meter. And that's good to know. Because the grid dip oscillator, a well-designed one with different plug-in coils, covers a tremendous frequency range, I think that Heathkit grid dip meter went from something like a couple of megacycles on the low end to something like 150 or 200 megacycles on the high end. That's a lot of octaves. Although it's not exactly calibrated in power output, and depending on how well it was constructed, the calibration of frequency is not quite as good as a synthesizer, a synthesized signal generator. Still, there are times when that's an extremely handy tool. For instance, lots of guys who used to do amateur radio television reception would take, for instance, a signal that was transmitted at 439.25 megacycles, amplitude modulated amateur television, put it into their 432 converter, and converted it down to, we'll say, 7 megacycles or 28 megacycles or whatever. But the way guys would transmit the audio on amateur television would be the FM modulate the same carrier. So the picture was amplitude modulation, and by narrow band FM modulation, the audio was put on. The television receiver that you were putting the signal into didn't see the FM modulation, but it was looking for another carrier that normal broadcast over the air uses. Normal broadcast over the air sends out a separate audio carrier 4.5 megacycles higher. Amateur radio operators usually didn't bother building two transmitters, one transmitter for the video and one transmitter for the audio 4.5 megs higher. They just simply FM modulated the video transmitter. By putting your grid dip meter near your receiver and setting it in such a way that it's either 4.5 megs away from the RF carrier coming in, or if it's beating it down to 28 megs as an IF, or maybe it's beating it down to channel 2, we'll say, 54 megs, your television receiver, and your television receiver is looking for that second audio 4.5 megs away. By beating your grid dip meter, by holding the grid dip meter near the critical circuits of the IF strip of that receiver, you're creating a phony carrier 4.5 megs away with the FM modulation. By beating the two together, the television receiver starts blasting out the audio from the loudspeaker while you're watching the picture, and it's a very simple system. You didn't have to build a second oscillator, and the guy doing the transmitting didn't have to build a second transmitter, and it works like a charm. Back to you, Steve. KT2MDP. You'll find it's a very handy piece of test equipment. K2LIW from TechNet.
Yes, very good, Dick. Yeah, well, like I said, I have the Versatune or something, the 259 or whatever. Not Versatune, it's something else. The 259, I also have the 269. And I know they sell a little grid dip coils, you know, from one, I think. They sell two coils, you know, and it covers from 1 to 170 megs. And the thing just looks like a little stubby rubber duck antenna. I imagine that's just the coil on top of there. And that coil, I guess, it's almost like a, it's, you know, I know what it is. It's a coil, but it's almost like a, what would I say, you know, I don't know, be a dummy load, you know, but it's almost like a dummy load that's set for a specific frequency. Is that what it would be, Dick? Back to you.
Now, you said a dummy coil, double frequency. Run that last sentence by again, Steve.
Okay, Dick, very good. Now, I'm just saying, it's what MFJ sells. It almost looks like a little rubber duck type antenna. You know, there's two of them, I guess, you know, different frequencies. I was wondering, you know, I would imagine just a coil, you know, winding in there. But, you know, is it like a dummy load? You know, like a dummy load, I mean, you know, a dummy load, you can go, you know, well, pretty much from, you know, DC to light. Would this be like a dummy load? I mean, it's not like an antenna, is it? I'm trying to explain this, but, you know, I'm sort of lost in it. It's just basically a coil of wire that resonates on a certain frequency. Is that correct, Dick?
Yes, I think I see what you're getting at now. Almost all the grid dip meters I have ever used, Steve, have the main inductor. It oscillates with an inductor and a capacitor. and that inductor, the coil of wire that makes up that resonating oscillator, usually is external to the box. It sits out top. That makes it very easy to bring it near a network that you want to make a measurement on. So in the case of the medium or high frequency one, it looks a little bit like a very fat rubber duck, and it may or may not be covered with rubber. In the case of the Heathkit grid dip meter, the actual resonating coils were about a 3/4 inch diameter plexiglass tube. The plexiglass tube was about 2 or 3 inches tall and had two great big contacts on the bottom that plugged into the socket on the top of the grid dip meter. The low frequency coil, you could see it had a whole lot of turns wound onto that plexiglass tube. The high frequency coil had very few turns, and the highest frequency coil was nothing but a very fat metal hairpin, which had no turns to it at all. That's the one that went to roughly 200 megacycles. So that coil sitting out top is the resonator. It is the thing you bring near the circuit you want to measure. And so it's external to the box, because if it was all built inside, you would have very poor coupling to the network that you want to measure. So to some respect, it looks like a rubber duck. I guess you could design a grid dip meter in such a way that the resonating coil for the oscillator is all internal, and then you've got a small coupling network that brings out a little bit of that signal to an external antenna that could be a rubber duck. That would be a different kind of a design. But most of the ones that I've seen, the external coil is the inductor that's doing the oscillating. Back to you, Steve.
Yeah, very good, Dick. Now, you explained it, though, once again. Yeah, that's probably what it is. It, you know, like I said, it looks like a little rubber duck, and it just screws onto the PL259 connector on the top of the MFJ analyzer.
So the output of the analyzer, Dick, K2RIWWB2HWW.
Okay. The output of the analyzer, meaning grid dip oscillator. By the way, what some people have done is to take their dipole antenna, Yagi antenna, whatever, that they use on ham radio, which has got a transmission line that comes into the shack, and they build themselves another connector. Say, for instance, your transmission line comes into the shack with a PL259. I've seen guys take an SO239 and simply bring a piece of wire, a piece of bus bar, from the center conductor, make one or two turns to it, and bring it to ground of the SO239 connector, plugs it into the 259, PL259 of their transmission line, bring the grid dip oscillator over to that coil that they just established. That's a way of coupling energy from the grid dip meter into the transmission line, into the antenna that's on the roof, in the tree, on the tower, whatever. And so you can measure the resonant characteristics of your dipole, your Yagi, your ground plane, whatever antenna you're using, with a grid dip meter. And there are times when that's very handy. Why don't you give us a couple more words there, Howie, as to what you were saying, K2RIW and the TechNet.
All right, Dick, the MFJ 259, 269 are the, you know, the antenna analyzers, and they have those little coils, you know, that you use to when you go near the circuit to see what the resonance of the other circuit is. So all that is just a coil. What you're looking at is that's a voltage control oscillator unit. The 269 is the UHF version, and the 259, I think, just goes up to VHF. Over to you, Dick. K2RIW, WD2HWW.
Now, that 259 and 269 of MFJ, it's called the antenna analyzer. I think you're saying it's got some grid dip oscillator, grid dip meter-like functions to it. And so you can use it to measure resonant frequency. Is there any way you can use it, Howie, to also get information as to what is the resistive component or the reactive component of your antenna? Back to you, Howie.
Yes, it's actually, yes, Dick, you can listen to both. You can look at both. It'll give you impedance, and it'll give you X of L and X of C.
Fantastic. That's a handy instrument. So you're buying one that's already built up or in kit form, Steve. This is something I don't know about. Maybe MFJ sells these in kit form, or sell them in only completely made form, or maybe you're making a Chinese copy. KC2MDP, KC2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, very good, Dick. No, I have two of them. They're pre-made. I don't think you can buy them as far as the kit. The little grid dip. It's just like an attachment. It just, you know, it's like an accessory. I think $29. You get two of them, and basically it just screws to the connector of the antenna analyzer. Back to you.
Great,
Howie.
These antenna analyzers are basically a signal generator, voltage controlled, and it has a digital meter that gives you both SWR, return loss, XML, and XSC. See what they do, they got a bridge inside of, you know, zero voltage bridge built in.
Sounds like a very handy instrument. Okay, I think we've answered Steve's question. I wonder if Steve number two or anyone else has a question they want to give us right now. Give us your call letters and your name. Give me and Mel your call letters and your name. K2LIW in the TechNet. Okay. Mel, somebody was talking to me, and I mentioned your name, and I made a guess. Back in the mid-50s, my family and I guess we used to like to root for the underdog. We were Brooklyn Dodger fans. And so the Dodgers, Ebbets Field and whatever, they didn't win very often, but we were rooting for them. You being a Brooklynite from way back, I wonder if you were also a Brooklyn Dodger fan. K2KEY, K2IW in the TechNet.
Okay, good evening. All this is K2KEY. Well, that's obvious. I don't think you'd last long in Brooklyn if you were anything but a Dodger fan. And I went to Ebbets Field as a youngster. I used to get to go to Ebbets Field every so often. And it was a lot of fun. They carried on. Oh, my God, these people lived and died with the Dodgers, really. They really were the Brooklyn bums. And when they left, of course, Brooklyn, when they were moved to Los Angeles, I thought that literally they actually wanted to hang this guy, Mel Malley, who owned the team, when he moved them to Los Angeles. I think he got so many threatening letters, he most likely had to have a 24-hour guard around him. They consider him, they didn't have terrorists in them days, but I guess they would have put him in that category today. So it was a lot of fun. Listen, Brooklyn had a, you know, unusual type of history. And unfortunately, sometimes it was portrayed kind of, as they say, how Hollywood took liberal use of Brooklyn as a place and the way we talk and all, of course, which was a little far-fetched at times. But it was always usually centered around, something to do with the Brooklyn Dodgers. You immediately associated Brooklyn, of course, anywhere you went, with the Brooklyn Dodgers. So anyway, over the years, unfortunately, I guess they were departing of the Brooklyn Dodgers. They said Brooklyn has never been the same, Dick. K2RIW and the TechNet, K2KEY.
WBJW there with a quick comment before I got to go, Dick.
Yeah, go ahead, Howie.
Yeah, just to let you know that QST, November QST, has a couple of, has an article on SWR. We talk about SWR versus transmission line loss. Very simple, but very directly to the point. And they also have an entire article. They compared all the different antenna analyzers, network analyzers, the one made by, Telewave, another one made by MFJ. They actually went down the whole thing. They got two good articles this month, Dick.
Good to know. Okay, thank you. So November, QST. When it comes to transmission lines, as Mel has been telling us by way of his instructions on the Smith chart, which tries to make sense of it all, the craziness of a Smith chart, of a transmission line, is that common sense would lead you to believe if you've got a 50-ohm transmission line and it's 100 feet long, you know that if you put a 50-ohm antenna on the far end, you will see 50 ohms in the shack. Everything's hunky-dory. Common sense would lead you to believe if you put 100 ohms on the far end, you're going to see 100 ohms in the shack. That doesn't work that way. Anything but 50 ohms, you're going to see some other crazy impedance in the shack. And why in the world a transmission line behaves that way is, there are people who have spent a lifetime studying that. And Mr. Smith's chart, his chart tries to make that a little bit more sensible. Another thing to know about is that the transmission line, when you buy it from the manufacturer, has an insertion loss rating. For instance, RG8U coax cable or RG223U. No, that's not 223. All of a sudden I can't think of the other number for RG213. It runs in the vicinity of 4.5 dB of loss per 100 feet at 432 megacycles. But that rating insertion loss in dB per 100 feet is based on the assumption you're using it at the rated impedance on the output. If, for instance, your antenna is not 50 ohms, but it's either 25 ohms or 100 ohms in my example, which means that your system does have a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio to some reflected power. And even if you use a good antenna tuner in the shack and you correct that 2-to-1 standing wave ratio so that your transmitter and receiver sees a pure 50 ohms impedance at your favorite frequency, because there is RF energy bouncing back and forth in that cable in between your slightly mismatched antenna and your antenna tuner in the shack, because the power is bouncing back and forth a few times before it finally gets radiated, it sort of makes some sense that the transmission line will have some extra loss. So I think this article is trying to make that phenomena clearer. So the 4.5 dB per 100 feet, the rating for RG8 or RG213U, it will go to a higher number, like maybe 5 or 5.5 dB of loss, if you've got a significant standing wave ratio in the system. So you don't always have to do a perfect impedance match at the antenna, particularly if you're on a low enough frequency where the feed line has got very little loss, then it almost doesn't matter. This is part of the reason why quite a few of the guys you've heard sign into the TechNet are really madly in love with open wire line, 600 ohm or 400 ohm open wire line. Not only can they easily homebrew it, but properly constructed, the insertion loss at HF frequencies is so low that it can tolerate extremely high standing wave ratios, and the insertion loss is no longer significant. When you've got standing wave ratio on a piece of cable, the insertion loss increases as a percentage of the normal loss. If your normal cable has 4.5 dB of loss per 100 feet, and you've got a high VISWA, you might get half or another dB of insertion loss increase. If your particular open wire line on 80 meters has only a tenth of a dB of loss per 100 feet, and you're running it with a high standing wave ratio, you'll get a certain percentage of increase, and so your 0.1 dB of loss might become 0.13 dB of loss when you have a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. So you can see on with open wire, very low loss line, on relatively low frequencies, you no longer worry about the insertion loss increase because of standing wave ratio. As long as your transmitter or your matchbox in the shack can properly tolerate whatever VISWA you've got and correct it to keep the transmitter happy, the whole system can work like a charm. I personally have used a dipole antenna on 20 meters that at one end of the band had a 20-to-1 standing wave ratio. I was running a particularly low loss piece of transmission line going to that dipole, which was mistuned like crazy, but the guy I was talking to on 20 meters gave me a S9 plus 10 signal strength report. He didn't know the difference. And so I was using a tube-type transmitter with a Pi tank network. We had a real tuning capacitor and a real loading capacitor, and for that particular phase angle, it could tolerate a 20-to-1 standing wave ratio, bring the transmitter into good resonance, dip the plate to the right amount of current, the whole thing worked. And so you tell the average amateur today with a solid-state transmitter that you've run a 20-to-1 standing wave ratio antenna on 20 meters, and he'll think you're crazy, because modern solid-state transmitters that don't have an adjustment control
for tuning and loading, unless you buy the auxiliary antenna tuner for it. But because they're fixed tuned, so to speak, and anything above about 1.8 or 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, the transmitter will start cutting itself back in power. By the time you get up to 20-to-1 standing wave ratio, if the rig is still on the air, instead of putting out 100 watts, it may put out 4 watts. And so the guy you're talking to is going to think you're running QRP, and you're going to certainly suffer. So modern-day transmitters can't tolerate it the way an old DX100 Chief Kit could take it, for instance. At certain phase angles, that thing could easily match a 20-to-1 standing wave ratio. The good news is our modern-day transmitters have got a lot more horns and whistles. They're a lot more compact. The bad news is that they don't have anywhere near the impedance matching range they used to have. So, let's find out if we've got any other questions before we go over to Paul and have him tell us what's the latest happening in space. Also, you guys have probably heard the FCC out of the blue made a decision this week to essentially abandon all Morse code examinations. What I've been hearing is that the Tech Plus license and the technician license are going to be merged into one particular license. There no longer will be a differentiation. We used to have to take a 5-word-minute code speed test, particularly for an amateur extra class license. That will no longer exist. Morse code as an examination phenomenon, when this judgment comes into effect, which I think is something like 30 days or so, there will no longer be any Morse code restriction to get a Morse code requirement during the testing for a ham radio license. The good news is that there's a lot of people out there who are electronically very savvy, but they think it's too much trouble to learn the Morse code, therefore they never got a license, and a lot of those people are going to join us. But the bad news is that there's a number of serious Morse code enthusiasts that are very up in arms and unhappy about this. They think we're going to go to hell in a handbasket, that the whole ham radio operation is going to become one great big citizens band. I think that's extreme, and I think it's not going to happen. Ham radio operators have a 90-year history of being extremely good at self-policing. I mean, if there are jammers on the frequency, if there are people that transmit out of band, transmit the wrong modes of operation, transmit profanity, do any of the things that they shouldn't be doing, ham radio operators are very good at finding out who's doing it and doing various things to stop them from doing it. So by the same token, if people, if we get a so-called whole bunch of riffraff, to put it in their vocabulary, is going to join ham radio because now there's no longer a Morse code filter. I don't think that's really going to happen. And even if it did, we would weed out those fellows real fast. The degree of technical knowledge that must be presented in the multiple choice questions in order to pass the test, for all I know, that's going to be increased a little bit. There still will be a significant filter to filter out people who are really interested in the subject before they get their license. So I don't think it's so severe. Yes, it is awful nice for everybody to have a basic Morse code capability, because in times of an emergency, that's an extremely effective mode of communication. There's a number of people who are alive today because they could take two wires out of a transmitter, bring them together, count those two wires together as a Morse code key, and send the Morse code when everything else had failed, and send out their SOS. So we should all keep our skill of Morse code. We should all learn it, because of not only the history, the heritage, there's a whole lot of good things that Morse code presents, but it's no longer considered a requirement for licensing. You would much rather spend the time making sure the person has capability of properly interfacing computing equipment with his amateur radio equipment. The FCC seems to feel that that would be more valuable than learning how to tap on a Morse code key. Each has its advantages. But if anyone has any further questions or comments about this particular subject, give me your call letters right now and name, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2KEY.
Well recognized. Anyone else? I'll bet you you're not too unhappy about this lack of Morse code in the licensing requirement, particularly in view of the fact that there's something like 25 or 30 other major technologically advanced countries in the world which have at least an entry class ham radio license, which doesn't have a Morse code requirement, if not having no Morse code requirements at all. So you could say we're, to some degree, joining the rest of the world. I wonder how you feel about this, Mel. I'll bet you you've got a 20 or 25 word minute code speed at least. K2KUI, K2IW in the TechNet.
Well, as a Morse code advocate here, but as far as amateur radio goes, I don't think it's going to have any great effect. Because I've never seen really that Morse code has held up anybody that really was determined to get an amateur radio license. And I've started a lot of people in amateur radio. But even with the entry levels that they've had in the last few years for getting into amateur radio, even with there hasn't been any sufficient increase, I see, in interest in amateur radio. In fact, we had this whole discussion this morning on the 10-meter net. My club runs, like many other clubs, runs a VEC program, and we don't get too many calls for people wanting to take the license. In fact, now we're running it only every other, if it didn't pay to bother, running it every month. In fact, we're lucky that even every other month we get one or two applicants that are looking to take the amateur radio test, even for, I guess, the entry level into amateur radio, the technician. But as far as the sense of Morse code, well, I'll tell you, as you said, it is a great way, especially emergency conditions. It gets through, simple way to send a signal, and DX stations that you're not going to find them on phones because they do not operate phones. One of them, a fairly rare one I worked a few weeks back, was a guy on an island called Chagos Island in the Indian Ocean. He's a soldier that's stationed on another island nearby, Diego Garcia Island, and he takes his little 706 transceiver with him with a automobile battery, and every so often he gets over to this island and he just strings an antenna between a couple of trees and basically gets on just CW because he knows he would be very hard to hear him on phone with such limited power and everything. So there's a reason to learn CW if you're interested in working a lot of these DX stations. Some of them somewhat rare stations, but are mostly exclusively to W operation. But like I say, overall, I don't think it's going to have any great effect on ham radio. The only thing is, I feel bad if they cut some of the CW band down, like 80 meter CW was one of my areas I like operating, beside the DX window, was many times to get up around 3650. And now that became part of sideband, new sideband frequency. So things like that. So I feel like they're squeezing us down. The CW operators are being, we're getting squeezed down bit by bit. And someday in the future, I have a feeling we may not have very much in the way of space for CW. K2RIW and the TechNet. This is K2KEY.
Very fine, Bill. Glad to hear that you guys are discussing it on your 10-meter net this morning. The proposed to get rid of the Morse code seems like about 5 or 10 years ago. My goodness, was there screaming and hollering over it then. And the first time they proposed to lower the, for instance, 20 word per minute code speed requirement for amateur extra and 13 word per minute code speed requirement for the general class license, the first time that those were proposed, people were very unhappy. And here we are, not very many years later, eliminating it entirely. It's just a matter of accepting the idea. Okay, let's pick up Paul before we put people to sleep. WS2N, I know that the space shuttle, I hear tell various predictions were being made that we're going to be able to sight them over Long Island, coming up over the horizon when they're still in the sunlight at dusk and we're in the darkness. And we were going to see them as two separate objects tomorrow night. However, I've been hearing that one of the spacewalks to install some of the solar panels. Turned out a little bit more troublesome than expected. So therefore, instead of the astronauts coming back on Thursday, they're going to come back on Friday. Instead of separating the space shuttle from the International Space Station on Monday night, and therefore you and I see them as two separate objects in the sky, we're going to see them as one single object tomorrow night, and on Tuesday they're going to separate. And whether or not they're as equally visible on Tuesday, I'm not quite sure yet. I did see the blast-off last, was it Friday night, Saturday night? I've forgotten which night it was now. And I filed a great big report with the Astronomical Society of Long Island. I watched the space shuttle during its boost phase. I was listening on 145.43 megacycles, listening to the Lockfield Amateur Radio Club repeat the astronaut audio while I was at my local schoolyard so that I could see very low down at the horizon, get away from all the trees. And with a set of 7x50 binoculars mounted on a tripod, I was watching that boost phase for the first, 12 minutes altogether, if I remember correctly. 2 minutes for the solid rocket booster, and then quite a few more minutes for the main engine. And then I heard the astronaut call for main engine cutoff, and I'm watching in the sky and seeing a great big triangular flame coming out of the space shuttle for quite a few seconds later. Then I saw the flame do a couple of popping sounds, so to speak, but it didn't make sound, but you know what I mean. Did a couple of pops, and then it never completely extinguished. I could always see a dimmer flame, which I think was the orbital maneuvering system, which according to my space shuttle operator's manual, the orbital maneuvering system is not supposed to come on for another minute and 30 seconds or something like that. And so either there was a lot of afterglow on the main engine, which I'm having trouble believing, or maybe nowadays they turned on the orbital maneuvering system, which puts them all the way into space, and that burns for a few more minutes. Maybe that gets turned on sooner these days. So maybe you got some explanation of all that. WS2M with our space report, K2IW the TechNet. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, I'm not sure what that is. I've seen that before. I didn't watch it Friday. I didn't go out and look. I spoke to a group of hams up in Connecticut. I talked to on one of their nets, and they did their, a couple of the guys went out and looked and did see it. I know what you mean. You can see like a triangle, like a, it flares up for a second or two, and then it dies out, and then you still see the engines. We're seeing it at roughly 6 minutes. A little over 6 minutes after it leaves Florida. A little over 2 minutes, the solid boosters separate. Well, that's back near Florida. They land in the water, and they pick them up and reuse them. And then 6 minutes after launch, roughly, that's when it gets up near us. But MECO isn't until 8 minutes, a little over 8 minutes. So it's over the North Atlantic when they finally shut them off. So you'll see the light from the three main engines. That's what you're looking at. What that flare out is, I don't know. I was curious about that myself. Never did figure out why we see that. And then after main engine cutoff, you have the separation of the tank itself, the external tank, and it drops into the ocean. So it's good that we could still see that, even so the space station is only 51 degrees. I would have thought a little bit more, a little higher in inclination. I remember the 63 degree flights they used to have, see the flights quite clearly, but this is good. That's good, because that space station is going to be up there for a long period of time, even after the space shuttle program is over and they continue on with the new Orion project. With the crew of six, they'll be able to launch in the Apollo-style looking spacecraft that's going to be built
we'll be able to see those flights when they go up to the space station as well in the future. So yeah, Dick, they're doing good. They've accomplished pretty much everything after launch. They did their inspection of the tiles with the robotic arm. They did the backflip when they got to space station. There was some little things here and there that they were curious about. I haven't heard much of it since the first report, so I guess they're not too concerned about it. They'll be doing that again after they separate from the space station. I guess they're not too concerned. I haven't heard much about that. They did install the P5 truss section, the truss that goes on the port side of the whole setup. They had 3 and 4 up there that was put up there 2 flights ago. This one attaches to that. And then the last flight, they put the that big solar panel, 240-foot solar panel up there that wasn't wired in. They've been running off the temporary P6 solar panel. That's also 240 feet long. That's been up there for 6 years. They need to roll back that half of that, roughly 120-foot or 110-foot piece. They need to stow that. That's what they're having trouble with. They needed to get that out of the way because the solar panel, the new solar panel, has to be able to turn 360 degrees, and it would hit the P6 panel if that was extended. So it looks like they're going to do another spacewalk tomorrow to try to manually crank that in, or maybe fold it, or pull the little cable one way or the other to try to retract that solar panel. Another issue with the solar panel, a couple of weeks ago we were talking about the power, trying to get the power from the solar panel to the Z1 structure. That's where all your converters are for your power to eventually get into the space station on the center, roughly the center truss section that's sticking out of the Unity module. Get the power back to this thing. We were talking about, is it an induction system or is it a direct current? I searched the internet left and right. I can't find anything specific about it. But I did notice in yesterday's spacewalk when Sonia Williams, she's up there mating and demating connectors to convert the power from the temporary P6 solar panel over to the permanent solar panel, and along with Bob Kerber, and they're doing this work, and I'm listening to a flight director, and he's talking about the what they're doing, and he did say that the panels are supplying the 155 volt DC, and she was connecting and reconnecting these terminals going through the DC to DC converter, and what they're doing is they're going from the 165 DC volts coming back from the panels and going into this 120 volt usable voltage that's going into the International Space Station. So that leads me to believe that they must have direct contacts or some kind of brushes or system in there to have this voltage come back. So I mean, it's just my guess, but I really don't know. It just thought that occurred to me as I was listening to the spacewalk yesterday on the 145-430 Vossville repeater. So back to you, Dick. Thursday they were supposed to be coming back. Now Friday they're coming back because this is going to delay the mission. They have the extra spacewalk. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
Thank you, Paul. Even though the voltage they run on, 165, 155, or whatever, and there's a DC to DC converter, the possibility exists that the DC to DC converter is part of the rotary joint of the solar panel itself. I'm guessing they're using numbers like 5 and 10 kilowatts of power, which would be numbers, let's see, with 150 volts, we're talking about lots of amperes here, and to put that many amperes through a slip ring joint and rotate once every day 360 degrees in order to keep it aimed at the sun as you're going around the earth, that's a lot of rotation that builds up in a while, and you're going to be galling those contacts. So I'm having a little bit of trouble believing. Also, you're going to wear out a set of brushes in that rotary joint mechanism if it's done with slip rings. I'll bet you will eventually find out that it's an induction coupling in that rotary joint of the solar panel. You can see that the joint, the rotary joint, is an extremely massive structure. I'm having trouble believing that all that mass is just the ball bearings and the gear train and the servo mechanism that steers it in the right direction at the right time. I think there's more to it. I'm guessing it could be an inductive coupling. Let's face it, the alternator in your automobile, Paul, has 100 ampere capability, and 100 amps that comes out is not coming out of slip rings. There are slip rings with only an ampere or so, which supply 1 ampere of current to the rotary field winding. But the real power output is by way of the three-phase winding, the rectifiers of the stator. So you could say 95 or 98% of all of the power coming out of the alternator of your automobile is inductive coupling, even though it's DC output. The three-phase and full-wave rectification give them 12 cycles, 12 pulses per complete revolution. It's a very high reliability system. Back in the days when generators used to really be generators with real brushes and commutators, those brushes had to be replaced periodically. And so when an alternator in an automobile fails these days, it's the bearing that fails, the pulley that fails, the fan belt that fails. Almost never is it the slip ring mechanism. You almost never hear about that because it's carrying very little current. Just the current required to operate the rotary field magnet that does the rotating. So I'm guessing there's something similar going on here with the space shuttle in order to get the reliability required. You certainly wouldn't want to go out there and replace brushes. Second of all, I guarantee there's some kind of a nasty mechanism that goes on with brushes in space where they can fail more rapidly. And the dust they create, the debris, grinding itself inside of the bearing mechanism in the gear train, that doesn't sound good. Now, when it comes to the shuttle itself, those flashes of light we see after 6 or 8 minutes when the main engine cuts off, I am guessing some of the flash of light is the way the engine is cut off. I've been told that you cut off the engine by killing the oxygen first and the hydrogen second. The reason you do that is you don't want pure oxygen going into the hot metal of an engine, because pure oxygen hitting that hot metal can create embrittlement and changes to the metallic structure of the engine itself. And they want to be able to reuse that engine and the rotary turbines of the compressor blades and all this jazz of the pump mechanism. So I think they kill the oxygen first, and so that flash that you see coming out is possibly only partially burned hydrogen, which is being cut off second. That's a guess. Let's see, what else? I wonder if anyone else has any questions as to what's going on with the space shuttle.